So the audience disappears when they turn the lights out. That's what it looks like from up here anyway. Good morning. So today I basically, let's see, I want to be able to advance slides here. So this is what I said I'd talk about in the abstract, and I'm in the session, and I just, I don't know, I stuck it up there for some reason. To summarize, what I want to talk about today is basically the main pipeline from markup to graphics in web browsers. So I want basically how browsers handle HTML and CSS and take that through this rendering path to the screen. This means there's also a few things I'm not going to talk about. One of the things I'm not going to talk about is resource loading. There's a whole lot of good information on that, and it's not something I'm really well qualified to talk about. Another thing I'm not particularly going to talk about is specific techniques. I'm going to talk a bit about how you can experiment in order to determine things for yourself about what's fast and what's slow. But I'm not going to spend much time on specific things that are useful. So a lot of what I want to talk about is represented by this diagram. Basically, this is sort of the path, the data flow within browser implementations as far as I'm aware of it. Now, I can't necessarily speak to what's in all browsers. I know a lot about Gecko, that's the layout engine used in Firefox. We also know a decent amount about WebKit because it's another open source browser engine. And then there's Internet Explorer and Opera, and we basically know nothing about them except that they mostly behave the same way, so we expect that a lot of things are reasonably similar. But that's basically a guess. So insofar as I'm talking about how browsers work, that's where this knowledge is coming from. So the core of what I'm going to talk about is essentially what's along the top line of this slide. How HTML or SVG or XHTML or some other kind of markup moves from being a file that you get off the network to being a tree represented in memory, to being another data structure that represents the layout, and then to being something that we draw to the screen. So, for a start, HTML and other markup languages are just a serialization of a tree structure. It's this sequence of bytes or sequence of characters that represents a tree structure. So the job of the parser is to do that conversion. And that's what I'm showing here. So the tree that the parser constructs is, we have a whole, one of the problems with browsers is that different browsers sort of invent different terminology and talk about things slightly differently. So we have about three names for everything. So this tree on the right, we sometimes call the DOM tree, or we sometimes call the content tree. And it's this tree that we construct from the markup is then exposed to script so that it's exposed to various APIs that you can get at through the DOM and so on. So the nodes in this tree are, you know, they're distinguished by being things like elements or documents or text nodes. Elements are further distinguished by being maybe HTML elements or SVG elements, and those elements are further distinguished by what element specifically they are. I'm saying this partly to draw a contrast with it later. So then after we have this DOM tree, we then want to use some other input. In particular, we want to use CSS as input to construct the second tree structure, which is in many ways similar to the DOM tree, but it's also different in a whole bunch of ways. So the purpose of this second tree structure, which now we actually do have three names for it. I lied. We had two the last time. So we sometimes call it the rendering tree. In Gecko, we call it the frame tree. And in CSS, we sometimes call it the box tree. So the purpose of this tree is to represent positions of objects, essentially. So everything in this tree represents a rectangle, or perhaps in some descriptions of it, a series of rectangles. And in many ways, it looks pretty similar to the content tree or the DOM tree, but not completely. There are some nodes in the content tree that might not have any representation in the rendering tree because they're not rendered, for example, because they're display none. There are some nodes that might have more than one representation for various reasons. The other big difference is about the types of nodes in this rendering tree. So I talked about how the categorization of the nodes in the content tree is based on essentially the markup language. The categorization of nodes in the rendering tree is based a lot on things like the CSS display property. So it's based on things like block versus inline. Though then there's a lot of things that have their own custom display rules, things like form controls. Or a classic example, SVG is another big set of types where they have their own display types that aren't associated with the CSS display property. So then, once we have this rendering tree, we need to, so the act of constructing the rendering tree is sort of one big thing we do to it, and that, right now I'm sort of lumping selector matching and computing style into that, though later I want to separate that out. But once we have this rendering tree, what we have to do next is compute all the positions, because the point of this tree is to actually display something to the user. So we do a process that we sometimes call layout, we sometimes call it reflow, where we essentially assign a position to all of the objects in the rendering, position and size to all of the objects in the rendering tree. And then once we've done that, we have the ability to paint these objects to a 2D graphics API. So that's essentially the piece of the browser that I want to talk about today. So the sort of the next big set of, well, so what I talked about is sort of a sensible concept of how you render a static page. But a lot of pages today aren't static pages. They're dynamic. They make changes. They have user interface. They change the DOM. They change styles and so on. So a lot of what I want to focus on today is how the browser responds to those dynamic changes. So one way you could think about this is, well, okay, they change the DOM. The page changes the DOM. So we just do all these things over again. That's the model of without optimization. But that's pretty clearly not going to work for a lot of things. For example, if this change in the DOM is a response to the user typing, we're not going to be able to keep up with the user typing. The amount of time it takes to do all this to a relatively complex page is longer than the speed at which many users can type characters. There's lots of other things. You want the page to respond quickly to other sorts of user interaction. So what I want to talk about are basically the types of optimizations that the browser makes. And I want to split these into three broad groups. One is where the browser can skip entire steps of this process in responding to some change. That's sort of the best. If we know that because of some change, we don't need to do some of these steps that I talked about, that's the best thing we can do, because then there's no work to do for that piece of the process. The next category of optimizations I want to talk about is where we skip part of a step. And what I mean by this is mostly that we might lay out part of a page or reconstruct the rendering tree for a part of a page rather than the entire page. So if a page changes the DOM in one small place, the browser won't go throw the whole thing away if the rendering tree needs to change. It'll just reconstruct a part of the rendering tree that needs to be reconstructed. The third set of optimizations I want to talk about, which are perhaps in some ways the most important, are coalescing changes. In other words, the page can do a whole series of things that that each alone would require the browser to redo a lot of this work. But the browser won't actually redo the work until it needs to do that. Now, there's a few caveats when I'm talking about optimization in general. Optimizations are going to vary across browsers. The way browsers behave in terms of handling content is probably more interoperable than the way they behave in terms of performance characteristics. But there are certainly a lot of common elements to browser performance, essentially because those are the things you need to optimize in order for web pages to perform acceptably. The second thing is that partly as a result of browsers behaving differently, a single browser can change the way they optimize things. So by and large, we try and make things faster, but that's not always going to be the case. In some cases, we might come up with some new optimization that makes a bunch of important cases a lot faster, and it might make some less important cases slower. And that's okay in many cases. So I want to talk first about this idea of skipping steps. So I've basically taken part of that diagram that I showed you earlier and separated out two of the pieces because two of the pieces that were previously in one circle just because we can skip them separately. So I've separated out the idea of doing selector matching and computing values for all the CSS properties from the idea of constructing a piece of the rendering tree, or the frame tree. So essentially the optimization code paths I want to talk about are represented by all of these arrows. And I'm going to essentially walk through what all of these are. So I want to start with some actual examples. So if we have a script that sets an attribute, some attribute that's not inherently presentational, the first thing we want to do is find out if we need to do anything in terms of the presentation at all. It might be that there are no selectors that have anything to do with this attribute, nothing, no way it can change the presentation. So essentially what we'll do in that case is we'll take the upper one of those first two purple arrows and just not do anything else. But that might not be the case. For example, there might be a selector in the style sheet that selects on that attribute. And if that's the case, we actually have to rerun selector matching. Now, it's possible at that point that we still haven't actually changed the set of selectors that matched, because this optimization to look at whether an attribute might affect what selectors matched is not the same as doing all of selector matching, because otherwise we'd be doing all of selector matching. It's an optimization to quickly detect cases where we know that it's not going to. So maybe this div isn't inside an element with ID list, so we rerun selector matching and nothing changed, so we leave again. That's sort of this blue arrow where we leave sort of partway through the process of style computation. But then maybe actually we didn't have that hash list at the beginning of the selector, and changing this attribute actually makes a difference to our style. So now what the browser has to do is look at the new style, look at the old style, figure out what changed, and figure out what to do as a result. So the what to do as a result is represented by these four red arrows I've drawn here. So So one thing that might be a result is that we have to redo our rendering tree construction and the rest of the process after that. So these are just a few relatively straightforward examples. Some of them are relatively straightforward. Examples of properties that would require us to reconstruct the rendering tree. So display and position and float are properties that affect what types of nodes in the rendering tree we're going to construct. So it's sort of fundamental to those properties that they require us to reconstruct the rendering tree. Some of the other properties here, like maybe the column properties or counter properties or quotes, are just in this list because they're not used all that often, and we don't necessarily worry about optimizing them that carefully. So in some cases, we use a slower code path simply because we haven't made a faster code path that's good enough for that case because there hasn't been a need to do it. So for example, changes to the quotes property, which probably most of the audience hasn't heard of, I'm guessing, cause this sort of the slower code path just because we haven't needed to optimize them better. So this is sort of another set of properties. These are the sets of properties where we don't actually need to reconstruct any nodes in the rendering tree, but we need to recompute positions and sizes again. Most of these, it's sort of relatively obvious that these are going to change positions and sizes of things in the page. So as a result, we have to redo layout, even though we're not reconstructing actual, destroying and recreating nodes in the rendering tree. Then there are properties where we don't actually have to redo layout, things like color and background, where the layout is still exactly the same, because all the positions and sizes are the same, but we still need to redraw. And then there's also another possibility. There's the possibility that we had this new selector match, but maybe nothing changed. Maybe we had a rule like p:hover background yellow, and the mouse moved into that paragraph, but the paragraph was already yellow. So we don't actually detect that there were any differences, so we just go off and do nothing. So those are those four red arrows there, showing sort of the possible ways we can skip steps. So those red arrows don't really represent everything. They represent the major cases. There's also a bunch of cases where we have custom handling to handle a dynamic change in some property that's interesting in some way. So for example, the transform property, we could handle changes to the transform property by just doing relayout. But authors actually really care about the performance of changing the transform property. So it has its own custom code path that's designed to do only what we need to redo when the transform property changes. So that has its own handling because we want it to be fast. On the other hand, the cursor property has its own handling because none of these paths would actually handle a change in the cursor property. All you have to do to handle a change in the cursor property is look and see if the mouse pointer is actually in the element that the property changed on, and if it is, change the cursor. It's about maybe 5 or 10 lines of code. But it's custom handling that because it wouldn't be addressed by any of these other possibilities. So now I want to move on to the second category of optimizations, which is coalescing. And basically, the reason we want to coalesce things is that authors might do things that would require us to redo the same work multiple times. So if a page sets the position property, which requires us to recreate the rendering tree, and then right afterwards sets the overflow property, which also requires the browser to recreate the rendering tree, we don't want to do that twice. We want to buffer it up and make that change only once. Likewise, if an author maybe changes the background color of an element and changes the opacity of its parent, those would both require us to repaint a rectangle on the screen, but we're not actually going to do two separate repaints for that. We're going to merge them into one repaint. So the question then is, when do we actually make these changes that we've buffered up? And one of the reasons we'd make these changes is that it's time to redraw. Basically, you know, monitor refresh rates are in the range of 60-some to 70-some hertz, typically. There's no point for the browser to redraw faster than the monitor is refreshing. If we do that, we're just going to waste CPU on something that the user is never going to see. So the browser sort of tries to maintain a refresh rate that's relatively similar to typical monitor refresh rates, so we're not wasting the processor time that could be used for something else. Now, the other reason that we'd flush our buffer of changes that we're coalescing is if script asks for something that requires processing those changes. Because essentially, the programming model on the web is under the appearance that that the browser presents to developers is that everything happens instantly. So we have to act like it happens instantly, which means whenever the author asks for something like a position or a size or a style that requires us to flush these buffered changes, we have to go flush those changes to give them the right answer based on what they've set, based on what the page has set previously. So I want to talk very briefly. So this is where sort of this is where we get into things where browsers are going to differ a bit more. Because in some cases, what buffer needs to get flushed for to answer a particular question can be a bit of an implementation detail. So this actually may be something that's Gecko-specific in that we have a set of things that will flush the construction of the rendering tree. In some sense, there's very little that inherently requires that, because it could be that there's only things that flush style, and there's only things that flush layout. In Gecko, we actually have a set that are in the middle for various reasons. So get a call to get computed style for some properties will do that. On the other hand, things that cause the buffer of changes that affect layout to flush are reasonably interoperable because there's a whole bunch of things that you can clearly demonstrate depend on knowing the current layout. These are things like calling get computed style on any layout dependent property, things like getting offset top of an element, basically anything that is going to tell you where an element is or how big it is. So one of the things that we see as browser developers quite a bit, that's sort of the classic way of defeating all the optimizations we do is defeating the coalescing optimizations. It's sort of the easiest set of optimizations to defeat because it's very easy to write a loop that changes something and then asks for something that causes us to flush one of these buffers, which means that instead of running all these changes that could be coalesced once at the very end of the process, we're going to run them every time through the loop. And this can be very expensive. So this is sort of the very simple example of what not to do. If you look at this code, there's a loop. The third line of the code inside the loop is getting an offset height property and setting the style of an element. So the first time through the loop, we're fine, because there's nothing in the buffer to flush, maybe. The second time through the loop, we say, oh, we need to get an offset height property. That means we need to have up-to-date style and layout, which means we need to redo all the style and layout computation that resulted from the set, the first iteration through the loop. And then we set the style the second iteration and repeat for the third iteration and so on. So this can make pages orders of magnitude slower very easily. And one of the reasons, now hopefully we're going to soon have better debugging tools for detecting this sort of problem, but one of the reasons that authors sometimes miss this sort of thing is that some of these things are hidden in frameworks. So there are things, inside of things like jQuery that will actually get one of these properties that causes a flush. So now I want to move on to talking about skipping parts of these operations. So I've talked about skipping entire phases of the process, and I've talked about coalescing. So one of the third of the optimizations I mentioned at the beginning is that we can skip a part of the process. So we can reconstruct part of the rendering tree, or we can redo layout for part of the rendering tree. And the performance characteristics of skipping a part of this process are different for each one of these. So for reconstructing the rendering tree is in some ways actually the simplest of the three, though there are a few interesting factors. So reconstructing a node in the rendering tree implies reconstructing all of its descendants, at least in Gecko, and I suspect that's also true in other browsers, although I'm not sure of this. So if you do something that forces a reconstruct on the body element, you're reconstructing the whole tree. So the other interesting thing is that there's a very tiny cost in reconstructing the rendering tree related to the depth of what you're inside. So if you're reconstructing the rendering tree for a node that's 200 nodes deep, there might be a measurable cost, but it's going to be pretty small. So otherwise, the cost of this is mostly proportional to the number of things you're constructing. So one of the things you might want to do is try and measure how expensive this is. So as I mentioned before, the ability to flush reconstruction of the rendering tree is somewhat browser specific, so I'm not sure how well this applies outside of Gecko. But if you wanted, for example, to figure out how heavyweight some piece of a page is in terms of what the cost of constructing the rendering tree, doing style resolution and constructing the rendering tree for that part of a page, you could test it with something like this. And the first thing I'd note here is that this example intentionally does exactly what I told you not to do a few slides ago, in that it forces flushes so that you can loop through a bunch of times and get a time that you can measure reasonably. Maybe 10,000 is a little high here. But the basic idea here is that I have a function that flushes one of these buffers. And again, in this case, that's what makes this example a little Gecko specific. And then I just want to time how long it takes to destroy the rendering tree for a node and recreate it and run it a bunch of iterations so I get a decent time. So I want to now move on to the next step in the process, which is doing layout. So layout's a bit more interesting in terms of the performance characteristics of skipping a part of the process. Because fundamentally, when the layout of one element changes, it can move all sorts of other elements around on the page. And that sort of affects the way the entire system is designed. So the process of doing layout always starts at the very top of the tree and propagates down to what needs to be changed, so that all of the rendering objects that contain this know how to deal with something inside of them that's changing. So in some cases, this can be something relatively simple. If you just have a bunch of divs, they're going to lay out their contents, and maybe those contents will be taller, and maybe they'll push down later siblings. But not all that much happens. If you're, say, inside of a table, a change inside of a table might cause the table to need to rebalance the widths of the columns, which might cause the entire table to relay out. And maybe our ability to detect that that change is or isn't going to cause a full relayout isn't perfect. So we might, although probably not, do this in cases where actually it doesn't change. So one of the important pieces here is that the cost of things that cause relayout is not just dependent on the thing you're laying out, it's very dependent on the structure that that's inside. And this is, again, something that you can experiment with, and I'll get to that in a minute. There's a few other issues I want to mention about layout, though. One is that recomputing intrinsic widths is slightly separate from that. I don't want to get too deeply into this, but basically, there's sort of two different phases to the idea, to doing layout, the first of which doesn't happen all the time. But there are a lot of concepts in CSS that depend on intrinsic widths, where, like, if you have a paragraph composed only of text, it has two intrinsic widths, the larger of which represents the width of the text all laid out on one line, and the smaller of which represents the width of the longest word, or the longest unbreakable piece of text. And those two intrinsic widths then have, there's then a, every element has those intrinsic widths, so we build those concepts up from those simple things by adding things like borders. Tables have a concept of intrinsic width, and so on. So recomputing those is a little bit separate from redoing layout, because some properties that require us to recompute layout also require recomputing intrinsic widths, and some of them don't. So this is, again, another experiment that you can do in order to sort of figure out how expensive some sort of a layout change is, which can give you an idea of how expensive, in terms of layout, the structure that you've built is. So this is probably more reliable across browsers, because the ability to flush changes to layout is something that's pretty clearly exposed, in that when you ask for the offset top of an element, the browser has to have an up-to-date layout at that point. So we clearly know how to... there's a clear way that has to flush layout, any buffered layout changes. So essentially what this example is showing is that we have a function at the top that just... that does this flush, and I've put that in a function just so it's clear. Oh, and I actually slightly messed up this example. I forgot to change the name of the function call. And then we set a property that changes. So then essentially we're doing the same thing. In a loop, we're setting a property that changes something that affects layout. Then we flush layout. Then we change it back, and then we flush layout again. And this allows you to measure how expensive a structure is in terms of layout. And in some sense, this allows you to experiment both with the structure that something is inside and with changes to the structure itself. So it lets, as a way to try and figure out what might be slow in a performance problem that you're encountering. So the final thing that you might be able to skip parts of is painting. So painting is actually a bit different in that in the other things I've talked about subtrees, and I've talked about nodes in the tree. When we do a partial repaint, we're not repainting a set of nodes, we're repainting a rectangle or a set of rectangles. So repainting is actually a bit harder to measure because the browser controls the refresh rate, and there isn't some mechanism you can do to flush painting. So there's some ways to spot very bad cases. For example, like in some browsers, you might be able to see slow repaints if you're switching tabs back and forth. You might be able to see slow repaints if you're uncovering a window. But that's going to vary depending on the way the browser and the operating system handle graphics. And it's only going to let you see the very bad cases, the cases where the cost to painting something is slow enough that you can see the delay. So there are some debugging tools, though, that let you see not necessarily the cost of painting, but at least let you see what's getting repainted. So in current nightly builds of Firefox, at least, I don't think it's yet made it to the release channel, But in nightly builds of Firefox, we have a paint flashing preference that will, so it's a hidden preference inside about config that lets you turn on something that will cause everything to flash whenever we repaint it. So this will at least give you an idea of what's getting repainted. Now, that said, this is also an area we're working right, at least in Firefox, we're working right now to optimize. And hopefully soon we'll have some pretty major improvements into what gets repainted. So that's what I wanted to talk about today. Now, I wanted to devote a good bit of time to questions. So I also have a few other links up here. So one of them is something you can look at, that window request animation frame is a useful API that I don't want to talk about in detail, but I have a pointer to documentation for it. Because what that lets you do is that that lets you connect to the browser's idea of what the refresh rate is. Because authors frequently develop pages that update things on a timeout. And essentially, they're guessing what the right timeout is. The browser has its own refresh cycle, and if you're going, and if you have the ability to hook into that refresh cycle, you have the ability to avoid doing extra work, but still animate something as smoothly as possible. One other link I have there, and I might add some more afterwards. I know maybe some of you were interested in hearing about page loading. Steve Souders has given a bunch of good talks on that, and his website has a good bit of information about resources about CSS and script performance in terms of how they affect network interaction and the process of actually loading a page. In any case, thank you very much, and I'd like to take questions. And I think someone can go around with a microphone. And we probably want the house lights up as well. So there's a... I think they wanted it on the microphone because it's being recorded. Okay, that'll work. So the question was, does the browser refresh rate affect Canvas refresh rates, 2D and WebGL? Basically, you have the ability to paint to a canvas whenever you want, but the browser refresh rate does affect when that canvas is going to get drawn to the screen, at least for 2D. I don't know the guts of WebGL. There might be something else going on in there. But I think basically it is going, you can still update the canvas whenever, but we're actually only going to refresh it at certain points.
As developers of really rich apps, we're forever trying to find ways to optimize our experiences. So I guess my question is, could you provide some context around the relative benefit for optimizing for things like reflows, repaints, versus optimizing for things like network latency and minimizing HTTP requests?
I mean, I think a lot of that depends on what you're trying to do. Some of that depends on whether you're building documents or building applications. But in the world of building applications, essentially, I think it's worth optimizing both of them. And it depends which performance characteristics you care about more and which ones you're having more problems with. I mean, optimization is something you do when you want to make something faster. And if there isn't a problem, you probably aren't optimizing it, and that's fine, because premature optimization is often a waste of time.
I had two questions. One was if you could compare maybe a couple of browsers, maybe Chrome, Safari, and IE, and do you know what kind of optimization tactics they might be using? And my second question is, between desktop versus mobile, how do you think the optimization tactics differ?
So in terms of comparing browsers, I'm not sure how well qualified I am to answer that question, because I know a lot about Gecko and I know a little bit about WebKit and not much about anything else. I think there's a whole bunch of cases where they're pretty similar, but it's really hard for me to say. In terms of mobile versus desktop, I think a lot of the optimizations are still going to be the same, in that mobile browsers are built on the same engines that desktop browsers are, and those engines are making the same optimizations. They might be somewhat more important on mobile in some ways. On mobile, you might end up delaying the refresh rate more sometimes and other things, but I don't think there's any huge differences that I'm aware of anyway. We had a question over here that's been waiting for a while. Yeah, you. Okay, so let me try and repeat the question for a start. So you said that you're working with a component system that, and I didn't quite follow the whole thing, but you're working with a component system that requires you to serve style sheets. Anyway, I'm not going to try and explain the whole thing, but the underlying question was about the performance of selectors, and especially selectors that are very long with a lot of combinators. I think sort of the fundamental thing about selector matching is that selectors are matched from right to left, in that the process of doing selector matching is something that we do when we're trying to construct a node in the rendering tree or in the box tree. So we do it as part of the process of finding the selectors that match a specific node, rather than, here's a selector, let's find all the nodes that match it, which is part of what dictates that it runs right to left rather than left to right. So one of the things, so essentially the most important thing about selector performance is that it's going to be faster the sooner it fails. Because the more time you have to spend looking for something that matches, the more time you're going to spend trying to match that selector. Now, there have recently been some new optimizations to selector matching that are somewhat changing this advice. So, sort of the classic selector matching advice is, if the rightmost part of your selector, in other words, the part after the last combinator, so after the last space, or the last child selector or something like that, should be as specific as possible. Because if that fails, then you never have to go looking at ancestors or looking at previous siblings, which is the part that can be the slowest. Now, that advice is changing a little bit, in that WebKit has recently landed some optimizations that will filter out at least some sets of selectors before that point. Similar optimizations are hopefully going to land in Gecko very soon. But I think it's probably still reasonably good performance advice for selectors. So, standing in the aisle?
Yeah. So the two examples that you gave about basically about testing a piece of code for performance issues and avoiding getting tricked by coalescence and whatnot, very useful. Thanks for that. what I'm wondering is, I think anybody that's gone from printf, you know, like printf debugging to find performance issues to using an actual profiler knows what a great jump it is and what a relief it is. I'm wondering if you know of any tools for, rather than just testing a specific piece of code to say, is this my performance problem, if you can recommend any tools for kind of doing general performance profiling across a poorly performing site.
I don't know of anything right now. I'm sort of hoping that some tools that are good for profiling these aspects of layout will exist in the near future. There might also be some that I don't know about right now, but I can't recommend anything.
In addition to what you've shown today, or do you have any lists of guidelines, checklists, say, look to see if you're doing this or you're doing this, besides the examples in the talk?
So one of the top guidelines, I think, is to try and avoid breaking the coalescing optimizations. That's probably the number one thing I would mention. I don't have any good lists off the top of my head. There are a number of pages existing about selector matching performance, but I don't think I have.
Okay, I just meant this seemed like the kind of thing that you're likely to have a list of five things you can look at if you're having this kind of problem. But okay, thank you.
This may be a little more basic question, but are accomplishing the same layout several different ways, like using negative margin versus relative position or M versus pixels, are there any performance benefits one or the other? If it's so fast, it doesn't really matter.
Well, the simple answer is yes, but I don't think that's very useful. I think, in general, I think it's often features might tend to perform better when they're used for the sorts of things they were designed for. For example, it's pretty common to do layouts using floats, and floats weren't really designed for that. Floats were designed for pulling little things out of the flow to float on the left or right side, rather than to do the entire layout of the page. And in some cases, their performance characteristics aren't that great. Though, in particular, that deals with... floats sometimes aren't that great in terms of dealing with re-layout when you have dynamic changes. And sometimes they can lead to excessive repaints, although we're hoping that's maybe Gecko specific right now, and we're hoping to fix that soon. That said, I don't know. I would hesitate to advise for or against using any specific thing based on performance alone, just because there are ways, even once you've chosen one concept, there are ways to improve any problems you might run into. Tables have their own set of performance problems, but part of the point of these layout systems is to let the browser do a bunch of work for you. And if you do all that work yourself in your own script, you might actually end up with something that isn't as good as what the browser's doing, even if you're trying to avoid using something that has some performance problems. So I don't know if that's useful advice, but that's what I have. Okay, well, thank you very much.